welcome to Bookworm on WERU-FM. My name is Brooke Minner. I am the library director of the Brooksville Free Library, and it's my pleasure to host this monthly show on WERU, where we talk about writing and Maine authors and books and all kinds of other things. My guest this month is James Horner. He is the author of the new novel, Victoria Falls. James, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks, Brooke.
Great. Do you go by James or Jim?
Jim is great.
Okay, great. So I'm excited to talk about the book. I really enjoyed it. But why don't we start out by reading?
Sure. And I've chosen a passage, actually, from the first chapter. And just to give a little bit of a setup, James Monroe is the protagonist. He is a World Bank official who's on mission in Zimbabwe. And so he just happens to be, as part of his mission, at Victoria Falls. And he meets a woman on an airplane ride and doesn't think too much about it. And then hears voices outside of his room late at night and realizes that it's the same woman who he already has met, and she's arguing with her husband. And he initially thinks, just go back to bed, but then decides to head down the path to try to discover where she is. I struggled down the pitch-black walkway, now only vaguely aware of the hotel 100 yards up the hill. I knew that the Zambezi River was far below, and in the complete darkness, I began to imagine that if I slipped and fell forward, there would be little resistance to my body rolling down the steep embankment and into the river. This imagined fear was intensified by the sound of the falls and the continuous clouds of spray that saturated the walkway and now soaked my white cotton shirt and chinos. Through the darkness, I saw a dim outline of a figure down and to my left. She was standing, facing the falls, on a small platform that extended 10 feet from the walkway. Although her back was turned, as I moved slowly down the walkway, I could see that she was crying, and her hair was already wet from the spray as she attempted to tuck a small strand behind her left ear. We were now both soaked with spray, which in the darkness seemed to accentuate the complete loneliness of the situation, and I suddenly realized how ridiculous it was for me to approach her on the small platform. She was a married woman who had been fighting with her husband. Her escape down the walkway had simply been a way for her to separate from him for a short while before returning to the hotel and to her marriage. I wanted to avoid attachments, but perhaps I was unwilling to accept the abject loneliness which now seemed to engulf me in indecision. At that very moment, she turned with arms crossed and began to walk back towards the pathway. I could have avoided her altogether if at that same moment I too had turned and started back towards the hotel. Instead, I froze, seemingly incapable of forming any response to her shadowy figure as she made her way up the walkway. Teresa, it's me. It was one of those moments when the sound of your own voice sounds foreign and unattached to anything. Now she was frozen and not moving. James? I struggled to decipher her intonation of my name, searching in that split second for some shred of reassurance that she was somehow glad to see me. What the hell are you doing down here? And in that 3 or 4 seconds, she had brought back the Teresa from the airplane, the cocktails Teresa from the terrace. She had moved quickly from the unguarded Teresa, perhaps even the vulnerable Teresa, to the persona who confronted all situations, even her marriage, with casual fearlessness. I couldn't sleep. I heard voices on the terrace and I saw you from the window as you headed for the walkway. It sounded contrived, but Teresa had assumed a certain trust towards me that was evident even on the airplane. It was completely non-judgmental, and it made me want to regard all things about her in the same non-judgmental way. As she took my hand and led us back up the slippery walkway, I was aware that just as I had guessed on the terrace, Teresa liked me because I was so very different from her husband. In me, she had already sensed a kindness and an acceptance that she secretly longed for in her marriage. I was already completing something in her that allowed both of us to ascend the hill to the hotel with a certain degree of anticipation about what might happen as we reached the summit and the familiar veranda where we had had cocktails just hours before. "Do you have any brandy?" she asked when we reached the top. "No brandy, but I do have some Canadian whiskey." "That will do. Mostly we need to get out of these wet clothes." I had no idea what she meant by that, but without any discussion, we entered the side door of the hotel and walked down the long corridor to my room.
That's great. Thank you. So, as you said, the book tells the story of James Monroe, a fictional descendant of President Monroe, who's working for the World Bank in Zimbabwe when we first meet him. So tell us a little bit about James, because he's a great character.
Yeah, so James is a middle-aged career professional, World Bank official. And he is outwardly very successful, but inwardly he is struggling. In fact, I would say that he is in an identity crisis. And so when we meet him, we are almost immediately aware of this sort of indecision about him. He's sort of living in this zone of indecision. And unfortunately, he's trying to fill that void with women, with liaisons, with relationships that he probably knows deep inside are not going to work out. And yet he continues to take that course until about the middle of the novel, when something happens that causes him to have to reevaluate his entire life and to set off in a new direction.
Yeah. And you're right. It's evident pretty early on that, he's struggling and sort of lost. He says something early in the book that to the effect of he keeps making similar choices that leave him feeling empty. And I was really struck by that notion. I think it's such a common pattern that people, particularly people in middle age, experience. So why was it important to make that point? And I guess, was that kind of the central notion that that brought you to the book, or did that come about later?
Yeah, so I think most novelists would agree that part of their writing, at least, is autobiographical. And so, when I was in Africa working as a consultant to the World Bank, I had just gone through a divorce, and I was maybe not to the extremes of James Monroe, but I was certainly searching. And that passage that you just mentioned a moment ago, where you sort of get on this treadmill, and sometimes you even realize that the decisions you're making are not good ones, and yet you seem to be incapable of changing course. And that's really where he is, especially at the beginning. I was fascinated by his character because there are also hints of goodness in James Monroe that we see even early on. So as the writer, I had to make him likable enough so that the readers were going to care about what happened to him. And that's not always an easy thing to do, to have him in situations where we watch him make marginal kinds of decisions, and yet we still want to hold on to him as a character, and we still want him to win in the end. We still have this hope that he's going to figure it out and he's going to make some strides and become a better person.
So you referenced your own background, and I'd love to hear a little more about that. The book is fiction, but just from reading the back cover, I know that there are some parallels with your life. So let's just talk about that for a moment. You too worked for the World Bank.
Yeah, and that's sort of an unlikely scenario of events that allowed me to go to Africa, to Zimbabwe, and to Kenya as a consultant for the World Bank. I was actually teaching the son of a man who at that time was the number two person for the World Bank for all of Africa. And I met him at a parents' weekend, and he was very happy because for the first time, his son seemed excited about school. And so I sat with Dunstan Y for probably a couple hours. And at the end of that time, he said, I would like you to come to Africa with me when I go to Zimbabwe this summer. And, you know, I sort of took that with a grain of salt because I figured, okay, I've met with a lot of parents who become overzealous about how well their children are doing, and they want to do something nice for the teacher involved. And so I really wasn't expecting much out of that initial commitment that he made to take me to Africa. But then I got a call a few weeks later from his assistant asking me to get all these shots. And so I did, you know, and that wasn't necessarily pleasant, but I got all those shots. And then I didn't hear anything for a long time. Finally, around the end of April, this same assistant of his called, and I thought, okay, this is where the other shoe drops, and this is where I'm going to be told that, sorry, the trip is not going to happen. But instead, she told me that Mr. Y was not able to go, but they wanted me to go alone on mission for the World Bank. And so,
wow. That's not something that happens every right. day.
Right. And I think the amazing thing is, I mean, my mission was to interview economists and World Bank officials and International Monetary Fund officials and all kinds of important people in Zimbabwe and in Kenya, and then to write a 40-page report, which I did. And the two things that I am sort of amazed about still is, one, during all those interviews, not one person looked at me and said, "You're not really a World Bank official, are you?" and then, you know, the other thing was, you know, I had this fantasy that when I submitted my report that I was going to get a call from the World Bank and they were going to say, "We don't know what you're doing in your real life, but we want you to come work for the World Bank." Well, that did not happen. But it was a great experience, and I think even then, I thought about, wow, this would be the great underpinnings for a novel.
That's a really kind of amazing turn of events. That's great. So getting back to the book, you mentioned, you know, wanting to make James likable enough, and I quite like James, but I really adored the character of Teresa, who you referenced in the first part of the reading. We first meet her early on in the novel. She's in her late 30s and on a safari with her family and has this chance encounter with James. So tell us more about Teresa and the role that she plays in the book.
Yeah, well, you know, I think initially, I wasn't sure where Teresa was going to fit into the entire narrative. You know, I thought it was really cool that they met on an airplane that was diving in and out of the canyon of the falls. And I thought her breeziness was so attractive, and her ability just to sort of not get too serious about anything. And yet at the same time, you know, I began to sort of design a story where she would return much later on in the story as the one who really became in some ways his savior. And, you know, she is an interesting character because on the one hand, you could say, okay, what kind of a woman would possibly think it was okay to sleep with another man when her husband is in the same hotel? And so I think it's a little bit off-putting to some readers. You know, they see that in the first chapter and they think, oh, well, she's a total lost cause. You know, I would never want to be friends with her. But, you know, she does have that little conversation with him at the train station before he leaves with Melissa Samuel. And she sort of pulls him aside and says, Well, James, you're at the moment, you're sort of the great American boy man, and you need to grow up. And her, it was more of a challenge to him, really. I mean, it was advice, but it was also a challenge to him that he did need to grow up. And she was maybe the only person at that point in his life who could say that to him and have it resonate for him. Because he does take that with him. He thinks about that last little conversation that he has with Teresa, and I think it actually influences some of his decisions later on. Mm. So yeah, she's a little bit promiscuous, but she's also wise. So that's an unusual combination.
I don't know. I think it totally worked. Because sure, she's making some, I guess, morally questionable choices when we first meet her, but she also just strikes me as somebody who is who's living her life on her own terms, mm-hmm. which is refreshing, actually, in a female character, especially. So yes, we'll get back to Teresa, but I quite adored her. So while James is in Zimbabwe, he meets an Australian woman who you've just referenced. Her name is Melissa, and they have a whirlwind romance. And he learns of her brother, who is in trouble. So talk about Melissa and what's going on with her brother, Jonathan, since it's obviously a central storyline in the book.
Yeah, so his sort of ongoing attraction to Melissa Samuel is that she has this sort of innate spirituality that manifests itself in a variety of ways. In her suitcase, she carries around not clothes, but philosophy books. And she's well-versed in Western philosophy, but then she also has this ability to sort of not just meditate, but to sort of go into this state where she is clearly understanding, not just understanding, but also expressing some very deep spiritual understanding that she has, and some very deep sort of convictions that are in her. And so James is fascinated by that, and he is drawn to it. And so it's sort of an early indication that maybe for James, this sort of void in his life, it has something to do with his lack of spirituality, of his lack of an ability to sort of recognize the supernatural. And so, she is, for me, the most enigmatic character in the novel. She's also the one where we have a lot of loose ends. We never find out really what happens to her later on. But she plays a very important role in that James just sort of heaps upon her all his hopes and dreams for what he wants his life to look like and what he wants it to be. And then when he realizes that she cannot, as an individual, meet all of those needs, it kind of sets him off in a different direction. But yeah, I actually have thought about sequels to Victoria Falls. And one of the ideas I have for a sequel is to kind of retrace their relationship a little bit. But then after he leaves and is no longer in her life, I'm very interested to find out what happened to her, because as I said a moment ago, she's a character who I'm drawn to.
It's funny because when we first meet her, and you know, she has a suitcase full of philosophy books, but you get a sense right away, or you know, I did, that perhaps something wasn't quite right. And I sort of wondered at first if it was just like a ruse, you know, like if she was carrying these books in order to, you know, project the sense of somebody with this kind of profound spiritual or philosophical life. But it sounds like you wrote her to be sincerely that way.
Yeah, although, you know, she does some things to him which are unconscionable, you know, and most people would look at their relationship and say that she was completely using him to try to help her brother get out of prison. And you could argue that, I think, very effectively because of the way in which she sort of teases James Monroe on a number of occasions and makes him think that this is going to be a real relationship. But then she backs away. She pulls away. And so she is manipulative. I think a lot of readers, maybe as you did, Brooke, come away thinking, oh, I don't know. I don't like her.
Yeah. It should also be said, when you first meet her character in the book, she's swimming near the waterfall and has a sort of close call. And it was written very effectively. And in fact, honestly, even just talking about it, like, my palms are a little sweaty because it's scary. You think that, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. So right away, she has this kind of high intensity way about her. And that certainly continues. So her brother, Jonathan.
If I could just say something about that scene, which is in chapter 3. I think what I was trying to do mostly in that scene, and it is a very exciting scene because she gets caught up in the current. She thinks she's going to be able to swim into this area, this whirlpool called the Devil's Pool, but she gets sort of pulled off in the other direction and almost goes over the falls and is saved by this very, for lack of a better word, talented man who is able to save her at the last moment. But really the key for that scene for me was that James is standing on the bank watching all of this and realizing how ineffective he is, that his physical prowess is just a shadow of this other, what he's viewing going on. And then also the intimacy, the almost instant intimacy between Melissa and this man who actually saves her life. It's so bad for James that he just walks away. He doesn't say goodbye to her. He just walks back to the hotel alone. So, you know, I think it's an important scene in that way. And then I don't know if you remember, Brooke, but later on in the novel, when he is about to, in his mind, save Jonathan from his plight in prison, he says to himself, now I am the man who is about to rescue, who's the one who's going to be the one who rescues Jonathan and also is the champion for Melissa. So that scene that you mentioned really stays with him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's a very powerful scene, and it certainly is an indication of what's to come. Her brother, Jonathan, is in prison in India for smuggling drugs. And because James has some connections through the World Bank, it's possible that he might be able to help him. So talk about how that evolves and then eventually, you know, what happens.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is that, as I said a moment ago, he is desperately trying to find a way to impress Melissa, and he even has this fantasy that he's going to return from India with Jonathan and that Melissa's going to meet him with open arms and essentially say, I will love you forever because you saved my brother. And that's actually a doubtful scenario, even if it had happened. But I think for James, he is putting himself into an impossible situation, and some of it is really sad in a way, because he takes all of this tuition money that was meant for his daughter and uses that supposedly to bribe this judge in India. And it's a very ill-conceived plan from the get-go. And yet, because he's a World Bank official and because he has certain credentials that get him into India and allow him to meet with this judge, it's still, that whole scene really betrays how ineffective and in some ways weak he is at that point in the novel. I think that in devising that whole thing, I did use some World Bank sort of connections. In fact, he meets with a man who is a resident of Bombay, modern-day Mumbai, And this man supposedly is going to sort of have a quid pro quo with him where James is going to help him to get this project approved through the World Bank. And then this man is going to help him to meet this supposedly lenient judge in India. And the whole thing backfires when James suddenly says, no, I can't keep my side of the bargain on this. And then in retaliation, this man has him meet with one of the harshest judges in Bombay. So it's, you know, as I said a moment ago, it's an ill-conceived plan. And yet, ironically, it sets the novel into a course of events that eventually does, in fact, change James for the better.
Yes, it is ill-conceived, and you feel as a reader that he is just so blinded by his love or lust or something, you know, for this woman who he hardly knows. And as he's, you know, going to India and meeting at this hotel with a judge, which right away seems not quite right. There's not just one person, there's more than one person. And things don't go well. And so James, in fact, also ends up in prison. And the prison scenes are difficult to read. The prison is awful. And I was wondering, you know, what kind of research you did in order to write those scenes and how realistic that sort of treatment of prisoners or abuse, really, of prisoners was.
Yeah, so in terms of my sort of reference points, I know a little bit about what it's like inside a prison, not because I've been in prison, but I have taught courses at the Wyndham Prison. And I guess the last one I taught was a 10-week course on forgiveness with 20 male inmates. And those courses are taught, you know, in the inner bowels of the prison. You know, you're not like in some sort of clean and bright classroom. You're in a concrete area that's not very pleasant. But I'm not suggesting even for a moment that the Wyndham Prison is even remotely like this prison, Arthur Road Prison, that I described in Bombay. The Arthur Road Prison, and I did quite a bit of research on that prison. Enough to know that it's extremely overcrowded, that the facilities are pretty horrendous, and that it's listed among the 10 worst prisons in the world. So some of those scenes, you know, I mean, one of the scenes that I wrote about him being dragged out late at night and essentially being tortured. You know, people have asked me, well, how did you come up with that? And I'll have to say that it's not something, that particular scene was not something that I'd seen before or read about even. But it the end of that scene was sort of the moment when James Monroe sees that he is able to demonstrate absolute selflessness for another person. And so that's sort of the beginning of his new life. When he sort of takes the torture that was meant for another prisoner who he knows and does it without that prisoner even knowing that he's doing it for him. And then his ability to do that, and you know, he's turning into another person right before our eyes as the reader.
Yeah, it's a very powerful scene, and it made me wonder, because it's such an extreme circumstance that he's facing there in prison, and yet he comes to this, you know, new realization about how he wants to live his life. I mean, did you have to write it that way because James is this sort of high-flying, powerful man who had to face something that extreme in order to get there? Do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if that is, if that's often the case. People need not that much, perhaps, but something extreme. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, other people who have read that, you know, I guess one person said that it was his wake-up call, but it's a pretty brutal wake-up call, if that's what it is. But It does force him out of all the sort of presuppositions that he has about his life and about his future. It forces him to live in the present, and it forces him to be vulnerable and to understand that brutality is sometimes the best counter for brutality is to show vulnerability. And so his vulnerability is really a strength in a lot of those scenes where, you know, friends, I don't know if you remember the scene where his friend is very sick and he asks for some medication for his friend and for Ramesh. And initially he thinks, you know what, these prison guards are not going to bring me anything. And out of the blue, this prison guard shows up with a bottle of baby aspirin and hands it to him. And that probably saves Ramesh's life, or it contributed to his life being saved. So I think the other side of that is that we do see moments in prison life where even the guards are vulnerable or show vulnerability or show kindness, mercy, however you want to frame it. And I think that's important for sort of the overall theme of the novel, that people are able to see that. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and I think James Monroe, we haven't really talked about the whole sort of redefinition of manhood that that is part of the novel. But I think that, especially in the second half of his existence, James Monroe does redefine what it means to be a man. Mm-hmm. And it's not being the tough guy. You know, it's being kind, it's being compassionate, mm-hmm. it's being vulnerable. And, you know, he even teaches that lesson to his son very late in the novel. Even though his son is only with him for probably less than a month, he does teach that same lesson to him. And, you know, you're right, that all starts in fairly brutal scenes in prison.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So the book chapters alternate between James's young life, which we've mostly been talking about, or his middle life, I guess, culminating at his time in prison, and then back and forth with his much older life. He's living in Canada with his daughter and doing very good work, working with vulnerable and homeless people. And so I was wondering, why did you choose to structure the book in that way, the sort of back and forth chapters? I thought it worked really well, but I was just curious if you started writing in that way or if that came later.
Yeah, well, I wanted the book to be intergenerational. So I wanted it to cover at least two generations. And, you know, there's a lot of talk fairly early on about how his son is in some ways kind of going through the same issues that his father did. And so his son seems insecure when we first meet him. And his son seems like he's searching and that he's desperately looking for some meaning in his life. And I think it's difficult to show that unless you are able to bounce back and forth between kind of the past and the present. If you think of the present as being all the chapters that take place out in Alberta, Canada, and the past being what James experienced both in Africa and India, then I just thought it was a more effective way to do that. I mean, I have to say that House of Sand and Fog, you know, sort of helped me to see how having different chapters in the novel being from different perspectives. For instance, all the chapters that are in Africa and India that are part of the James Monroe narrative are in first person. And then all the chapters out in Western Canada are in third person, except for the last one, after James has died. Then his son Charlie takes on the first person narration, mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I wanted to And then the other thing is, I think ironically, I'm pretty sure that the way that chapters are sequenced, both the father and the son are in prison at the same time, even though it's 30 years later.
Mm-hmm. I love Andre Debuse's work, and House of Sand and Fog was a really important book to me as well. That's interesting that you should mention that. So, yeah, let's talk about Charlie. James's son's name is Charlie. We first meet him, and he has pretty recently learned that James is his biological father, which is not a thing that he knew. He's going to Canada, but he is facing, as you said, troubles of his own. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the dynamic in his marriage, because things aren't going very well. they have a teenage son. So talk a little bit about Charlie and specifically, what's happening with his marriage when we first meet him.
Yeah, so I mean, his relationship to Heather is, to put it mildly, it's not going well. So I think that Charlie is responsible for most of that angst in his marriage, because I think in Charlie's mind, he's willing to give some of himself to the marriage. But for some reason, he's not all in, and so he makes excuses about why his marriage isn't what he wants it to be or what he thinks what it should be. And I think Heather, rightly so, is indignant a lot of the time, because he has sort of gone off on this adventure to find his real father and left her with Ryan and has given, he actually lies to her on several occasions when they have those phone conversations. Mm. And he's not able to see anything really from her point of view. It's always from his point of view. And so, and you wonder about what James Monroe's first marriage was like, and we know very little about mm-hmm. it. But you wonder if some of those same oppositional characteristics were what tore apart his marriage. You can only venture sort of to guess what may have caused that divorce. But clearly, Charlie is. Just the fact that he would even entertain the idea that maybe he and his half sister, might have some kind of relationship. he's a little distorted. And so it's amazing how quickly he sort of comes to that realization. And I think it takes, just like his father, it takes sitting in a prison cell for him mm-hmm. to sort of wake up,
mm-hmm.
So
that's interesting, because I had a slightly different take on Charlie and Heather, because although hearing you say that, you're right, and he is a little delusional about some things, but he also talks about how when they first met, she was sort of easygoing, kind of open minded, and has become kind of bitter and resentful, which is very difficult to live with. So I took a little pity on him for that.
Yeah, well.
But it's complicated, who knows why she became that way, and certainly he probably played a role.
Well, and he's very interested in sort of keeping his image in his business, and he faults her for not sort of playing that game of the affable wife who, is always sort of helping him to do better in his career. Instead, she just sort of shuts down at some point and refuses to even go to some of those events. And so, yeah, you can sort of look at it from both sides. But I think that, poor Ryan, who you said, I'm not sure if he's sort of a preteen. I think he's probably like in seventh grade or something.
Uh-huh.
And all he wants is for his dad to go to his soccer games. You know, that's right. That's all he's looking for. But anyway.
So, yeah. So there's this sort of second storyline that happens. He goes to Canada to meet his father. His father, he shows up unannounced and James is out of town. But instead he meets his half-sister. And then very shortly after, maybe that day, I don't remember the exact sequence now, but she actually goes missing. Mm-hmm. And so the book kind of takes a turn and really becomes a mystery of sorts. It feels like a mystery when you're reading it. So talk about what happens there. And you've referenced that he does end up in prison. But talk a little bit about that storyline and how that got into the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that whole arrival scene, and Brooke, I'm just totally blanking on my character's name here.
The half sister.
Yeah,
it's funny. I'm blanking on it too. It'll come to us.
Anyway, that whole arrival scene is a little bit disconcerting. I thought, in that, you know, he arrives there like it's 6 o'clock in the morning. And she, you know, answers the door sort of in her robe and, you know, and immediately invites him in.
Right.
And, you know, I do think that people who live out west are much more trusting and much more. So, you know, nothing's going to happen here. But it did seem a little crazy that she would take him at his word, that his father was friends, that his mother was friends with her father, and yeah. And that, you know, everything was on the up and up, and he was just out there to hopefully, you know, tell her father that his mother had mentioned him right before she died. I mean, it just seems a little crazy that he would have driven that distance just to say that to her. And yet she accepts it at face value. And mm-hmm. So that's a little bit crazy. And then just the fact that also, you know, when that mechanic comes to fix the car, you know, she gives no thought to, again, going out into the driveway with her robe on and cowboy boots or whatever it was. And, you know, I think that she was not very savvy about, you know, possible intentions of other people. You know, she's just very trusting and sort of innocent in that way. And so when she is sort of violently kidnapped and taken away, there's this sense not only of Charlie having, you know, not done the right thing, or that he was somehow partly responsible for what happened or whatever. I think he feels a sense of guilt, and I think that contributes to the fact that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you know, show up and start questioning him. And he sort of has this sort of guilty aspect to him that doesn't help his case at all. But that also, ironically, provides the context for his meeting with his real father. You know, that's when James Monroe actually shows up. And he immediately sees how patient his real father is. And he immediately sees how sort of methodical he is. I mean, his daughter is missing, and yet he seems to be pretty calm in that whole situation. And it's so different than the sort of frenetic James Monroe that we see early on in the novel. And by the way, his half-sister's name was Jenny.
Jenny. Yeah, right. So what it made me think is that the older James, he finally grew up. I mean, he is now sort of an actual grown up who can deal with crises in this case. And it's then, of course, the counterpoint is Charlie, who is kind of this middle-aged guy. And he's just, not only is he lying to his wife, but he sort of lies, or kind of lies by omission, to the police. I mean, every time that he's doing this, you're, you know, you can't help but think, like, you know, get it together. Like,
right.
This is not
right.
going to turn out well for you.
Right.
But it's like he can't help himself. You know? So it the book it really is a fantastic read, and I love the scenes in Canada and the not knowing, although you have a hunch of what has really happened to her, but you don't know until the very end, and we won't give away the very end. We obviously want to encourage listeners to read the book, but I thought it was a fantastic read. It was hard to put down, and so I will highly recommend that people find the book. It's called Victoria Falls by James Horner, and you should ask for a copy at your local library or bookstore. So we have just a few minutes left of the show, and I always love to hear from authors what they're reading. You've referenced Andre Dubuque, so I'm thinking perhaps we have similar tastes. But what have you been reading lately that you have enjoyed and would recommend for our listeners?
Yeah, so my daughter is a junior in high school, and she came home, I guess, the third day of school and said, "Dad, we're reading this novel called Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad." And because I had read Heart of Darkness before, and because I actually taught Heart of Darkness at one point, I said to my daughter, "You know what? We're going to read it together." And I said, "This will be such a fun thing." And she wasn't that enthusiastic, really. I mean, her attitude was, "Dad, if you want to read it again, that's fine. But, you know, I have to read it for class. And so, you know, please don't give it away. Please don't tell me parts that I don't need to have, that I haven't read yet, blah, blah, blah." But I will say that we have had some really great discussions already about that novel. And I'm a huge Joseph Conrad fan. So, I, you know, the thing I like about Conrad is that he is very subtle in his character development, so that, you know, you meet these characters and you sort of have these hints of like what their flaws are, but you don't actually see them in being fully flawed until much later on. And it's he's a master of character development. And I sort of think about him when I'm writing.
I'm glad to know that's being assigned in high school. That's a great choice. And what about you? Are you working on another book?
Yeah. So I think I mentioned earlier that you know, I feel like there's sort of two directions I want to go. One would be a sequel to Victoria Falls, where I would pick up the lives of some of the characters that were introduced there, such as Melissa Samuel or maybe Charlie Benjamin. But the other book that I'm working on is a book that takes place down in the Caribbean. It's called Marigot Bay. And I've written, I guess, 5 or 6 chapters. And again, it's a mystery. It's an adventure. It takes place on board a vessel. And it's a chaperone, a high school chaperone, with 8 high school students with him. And something happens to one of the students. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. Is it Marigot Bay? Is it St. Martin? That Marigot or no, a different one?
No, Marigot Bay is actually in St. Lucia.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And it's the bay where they filmed Dr. Doolittle with Rex Harrison. I mean, that was probably 50 years ago. But no, it's one of the most beautiful anchorages in the Caribbean. Mm. And I used to take kids on charter vessels on 1-week trips down there. So I know the whole landscape, or seascape, as it were. And yeah, I think it's the thing that I'm struggling with is that one thing I loved about Victoria Falls is that it had a moral dimension to it. And so far, the novel that I'm working on now just seems like a romp, you know. So I've got to sort of think more about that.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I can't wait to read it when it comes out. And I just really want to thank you for coming up and being a guest on the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
Yeah, of course. So please get a copy of the book. It's called Victoria Falls by James Horner. And it is a great read. I highly recommend it. Before we wrap up the show this month, I just wanted to share a little information with you about WORD, the Blue Hill Literary Arts Festival. It's coming right up. It takes place in various venues throughout Blue Hill, October 24th through 27th. The opening kickoff night on Thursday, the 24th, is at the Cynthia Winnings Gallery from 4 to 6 p.m. It is an exhibit of work by Blue Hill Peninsula artist celebrating the intersection of the visual arts and the written word. I've seen the list of artists, and it looks fantastic. On Friday, the 25th, I will be interviewing the keynote speaker. His name is Dave Cullen. He's the author of Columbine and Parkland. He's an investigative journalist. I'm about halfway through Parkland now, and it's really hard to put down. It's a very, very well done book about not so much about the shooting and the tragedy that happened in Parkland, but really about the student activism that grew out of that event. The festival continues throughout the weekend at the Blue Hill Library, places at the Congregational Church and all along Main Street. You can see the schedule and sign up for workshops at wordfestival.org. And again, that is the WORD Literary Festival in Blue Hill, October 24th through 27th. We're going to end the show this month with an audio essay by Castine writer and educator Todd Nelson. Todd occasionally contributes these essays, which are about books and writing and reading, to Bookworm, and we're always happy to have him on the show. I will be back with you next month, the second Thursday of November at 10 o'clock. My name is Brooke Minner, and this is Bookworm on WERU.
My bookshelves, myself. We were packing, again, downloading all our bookshelves into cardboard boxes. And books, I was thinking as I filled those boxes, are a geography of personal history, a miscellany of lives. One would think I had never given a book away. Here's my college English major collection, side by side with my English teaching career collection, beside the books of childhoods, my parents, mine, my children, and the arc of locations and relocations from coast to coast over 35 years. Packing is a reunion with old friends and former selves, a review of a lifetime of reading habits. Sitting on the shelves, the books are silent. Being carefully sorted, packed, and boxed for a move, they begin to speak. These are indeed old friends. They are my back pages of location, development, thinking, ambition, and tender affinities. They bookmark my life. Here's the red book of London street maps from the early 1970s, when I was an American high schooler, liberated from American suburbia, exploring the worldly metropolis. Here are the map books of France, Scotland, regions of the U.S., each summoning a pang of longing for their blue highways and meals and local accents and landscapes. Here are the childhood books of my parents, ceded to succeeding generations, artifacts of a family lore of reading, some nearly a century old. I noticed my childish scrawl on the title page of Lone Cowboy, a favorite of my mother's. Here are the thick poetry anthologies from college courses, waymarks of an English major and breadcrumbs on the path toward teaching and writing. And then, volume after volume of complete, collected, selected, and new poems by a myriad of authors. My tastes are showing. Each book's table of contents is starred, a running record of what I liked and when. As I put the books into boxes, their covers and dog-eared pages create mini-reunions. Here is E.E. Cummings, the big red collected poems, my first personal acquisition, a Christmas present when I was in high school. Here goes Dylan Thomas, a favorite ever since Mr. Walker's 12th grade English class. Yeats and William Stafford get boxed with Wendell Berry and Philip Booth, once our neighbor in Castine. I have his portable typewriter. Along comes Billy Collins and the poets he championed while poet laureate, Ron Kirchhey, Dana Gioia, Lewis Jenkins, the poets of teaching, poems that made a particular point for a particular class about how a poem means, or the music of words, or the taught rhetoric of sense and sensibility. That's the name of an anthology. Ah, Richard Wilbur. My copy of his selected poems is signed to my father. They must have met for an interview. Czesław Miłosz, Seamus Heaney, Whitman. There is no rhyme or reason here, except as my bookshelf is the mosaic of understanding and a world view. Eclectia. Wendy Cope, Virginia Hamilton Adair, Charles Simic, Garcia Lorca, Sharon Olds, Naomi Shihab Nye. I am suddenly in the audience again at 100 readings, videos, podcasts, talks, classes. How will I ever get any packing done with these interruptions? And there are still the nonfiction, fiction, history, art books, photo albums, and dictionaries to stow away. Doesn't everyone have all of Shakespeare's plays in single-volume, complete works, as well as the individual plays? You don't keep 5 years' worth of poetry magazine handy? How do you live without bookshelves lined with verse, just in case you need to dig out an elusive line or le mot juste? Our moving truck would carry mostly books, it seems. In transit, I would mull this rendezvous, rolling the titles over on my tongue with new savor, nostalgia, and longing. And when the box is open and it's time to reshelve the books in a new home, it'll be déjà lu all over again.